Like Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. For most of us, math is terrifying. Even if we did well in school, few of us see how math has anything to do with our everyday lives, save for calculating a tip or a batting average or figuring out what 30% off of $8.99 means in real money. But Wisconsin mathematician Jordan Ellenberg says we need to rethink our relationship with math. Ellenberg's new book is called How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking. He visited with us in the Lake Effect studio recently and told Bonnie North why he believes we don't already get that math is part of everything.
It's not something that everybody wakes up in the morning thinking like math is wound up with the ordinary things they're doing in their day. That's certainly the way that mathematicians see it. I think it's the way the math educators see it. But as you say, it's not so much the conventional wisdom. I think part of that is because we are trained to see math as nothing but the formal process of adding numbers together, multiplying numbers together. I mean, those things are math, to be sure. They absolutely are. But they are not all math is. If they were all math was, why would we have been doing it for so long? Like, why would it be such a rich, deep part of human history?
So what's going on? Are we teaching math the wrong way? Are people just not being exposed to it in a way that encourages them to think about it in a bigger sense?
Well, it's a difficult question. And one thing I always want to avoid is acting as if there's some magic wand you could wave and do things differently in an eighth grade classroom and suddenly everybody would love math. I actually don't think that's true. I think in some sense, the way I describe it in the book is that let's take basic arithmetic, for instance. Some people have a lot of fun learning that. Some people don't. But it is true that to think about richer quantitative questions, you do have to have a certain amount of facility with arithmetic that takes a certain amount of training. So in the book, I sort of compare that to the drills that you do when you learn to play a sport like soccer. I don't think anybody really thinks that dribbling between cones is a lot of fun, but I think people enjoy the skills that that allows them to have, right? In a game, they see the difference between the people who have practiced and trained and the people who have not. So in some sense, the relationship between that kind of work and mathematics in full is like the relationship between dribbling drills and soccer.
I was thinking as you were talking about that from a musical perspective, it's like learning scales, learning your scales, learning the fingerings on an instrument, that you have to practice those things in order to make music. You can't do it without, I mean, you can make bad music, but, you know, you have no facility. And I often think of mathematics, and this is me personally, I think of it as a language I don't quite get. You know, I want to understand it, but I don't quite get it. And so it's like, how do we get people to not give up before they get to the good stuff?
Well, first, before I answer that, I'm very interested in the metaphor you use, and I want to push on it a little bit, because it's true that if you were, let's say, trying to learn French or Chinese or something like that, it is a different language, and right, you would, on the one hand, be able to sort of glimpse its beauty and its charm, but also not really understand it and feel like there was a gap. And yet, the things that people were talking about in French would be the same things that you talk about in English. It's not really a different subject. It's just a different way of talking about it. And I think mathematical language is very much the same. Like, yes, it is a language that has to be learned and it requires some training. But the things that we think about when we think about math are the same things that we think about when we don't think about math, expressed in a different way.
So how do we get people past, you know, the soccer drills or the musical scales or the, you know, memorizing your grammar rules? How do we get people past that and into the language where you understand it more fully and understand how it actually affects everything that we do?
You know, when you say how can people do that, I think the answer is really different for different people. I'd give one answer if we're talking about kids who are in the eighth grade, and another answer if we're talking about adults. So, I mean, for adults, I think the key thing is just lifelong learning, that we have an educational system now where typically people graduate from high school or graduate from college or get whatever the last degree is that they're going to get. And they're like, well, now I'm done learning. I know what I'm going to know.
And I'm done with math, particularly.
And especially math, right? Because other kinds of learning, people still take up the cello, right? People still learn a little bit about Renaissance art, but you rarely see people think of mathematics as part of their lifelong learning, like what they mean to pick up when they're 35 or 40 or 55 or even 70. There's no reason that that should be the case.
And I guess that's my question is how do we in a general way, I mean, do mathematicians need to be doing like what you're doing, trying to open the door a little bit to a world that a lot of people think doesn't apply to them?
Yeah, and I think that a lot of mathematicians are doing that and always have been doing that and are doing that kind of in different ways. I think what's so cool right now is that we're in a moment where a lot of people are doing what I call outward-facing mathematics. Some are within the profession of mathematics, like me. Some people, like Nate Silver, are not professional mathematicians. But if not everybody listening knows who we're talking about, Nate Silver is a guy who analyzed election polls for the New York Times and gained a lot of fame doing so. Now he has his own site called 538. And he's done a huge amount just to sort of emphasize to people what the world looks like when you look at it through a quantitative or through a statistical lens.
So give me some examples from, you have some great ones in the book about how thinking mathematically either changed the way we as a culture think about things or could have if we had applied thinking mathematically.
Well, one that I like a lot is it's actually a story that I start the book with. It's a story of a guy called Abraham Wald, who was a mathematician and a statistician who fled Austria at the outset of World War II and ended up in New York working in a top secret military installation. It was a military math installation. It was kind of like the Manhattan Project, except it was actually in Manhattan up by Columbia University. And that group, his group of people, was faced with the following problem. The generals came to him and said, "We're looking at the planes that are coming back from flying missions over Germany, and we've noticed something. We've noticed that the bullet holes are not distributed evenly across the plane. They're getting hit more places, some places, than others. There's more holes in the fuselage, less holes in the engine. And what we're trying to figure out, mathematicians, is there like a formula or something that will tell us how much more armor we should put on the fuselage where the planes are getting hit more? Like, is there some way you can just calculate how much more armor we should put there?" And what Wald told them is that they had it completely wrong, that they needed to put more armor where the bullet holes were not. More armor on the engines, less in the fuselage.
And I think you say in the book, and that's because he said that the planes that aren't coming back are likely the ones that got hit in the engines.
Exactly. So it's not that Germans can't hit the plane on the engine. It's that when they hit the plane on the engine, the plane is not coming back. It's not part of their study. It's not part of their sample, as you say in statistics. So in some sense, I think this typifies exactly what the mathematician's real role is. Some people see the mathematician as a kind of very big calculator on two legs whose job is to give the right answer when asked a question. But in reality, the role of mathematics is to formulate the right questions. That's exactly what Wald did.
And that leads me to my next question. Can mathematics ever be wrong? Because that's part of your subtitle, or the title of the book, How Not to Be Wrong. Can mathematics ever be wrong? Or does it exist in some sort of like platonic ideal where whether we look at it or not, there it is in its perfection? Do we just not apply it right if things don't come out right? Am I asking the right question?
No, I mean, I think, again, this is like the word mathematics is a bit of a fuzzy one, but certainly mathematical computations can mislead, right? We all know this, and in some sense, we're wary of it. Sometimes I think overly wary, I mean, to the point that people will sort of cynically say, like, oh, statistics can't be trusted. I think that's a terrible mistake. If you throw aside your ability to look at things quantitatively, you know, it's like cutting off one of your feet. It's like, why lose like one of the basic tools that you have? But what is true is that you have to be able to engage with those numbers in a meaningful way and not be bullied by them, not be intimidated by them, not let the appearance of a number on a TV screen or on your phone or in a newspaper, not let that be the end of the conversation, but rather the beginning. You'll often see people saying things like, okay, 95% of the income gains over some period of time went to the top 1% of the population, you know, as a way of illustrating like what's going on with income inequality, that the top 1% are thriving while everybody else does badly. That's true, of course. Income inequality is a real thing, but I think that that is a bit misleading because what you often see is it says, oh, 95% of the income gains accrue to the top 1% of the population. Well, that makes you feel like there's nothing left for everybody else, right? But in fact, often when you drill down into those numbers, you'll see that let's say the next 9% of the population, so the sort of people who are well off but not super wealthy, maybe they got 30% of the income gains. Well, then you say, well, how could they get 30% if the top 1% already got 90% of the income gains? Well, that's because the bottom 90% actually lost money. over that period of time. But the point is that by saying 95% of the gains went to the top 1%, you're giving the impression that the very rich got everything and everybody else got nothing. Whereas quite often, the truth is that the boundary line is somewhere else. And like not only the very rich, but also the people who are well off and doing fine but not rich. Those guys are doing okay too. And it's really the middle class that's getting the shaft.
So is that because the people who are reporting those statistics don't really understand what they're saying?
I think they are saying words and reporting numbers that are literally correct. And the point is simply that that might not be the right question to ask the numbers under that circumstance.
And it sounds like if we, again, as a culture, had more math literacy, had more understanding of how those things work, that we wouldn't be taken in as easily by false correlation.
Yeah, although again, you know, the word taken in suggests that I think that people are trying to mislead. And I think that's sometimes true, of course, and I give some examples in the book where it is true, but I don't think that's generally the situation. I think people are doing their best.
Yeah, and it just sounds like, you know, we all need to kind of up our mathematical game a little bit, you know, to make it better. There was an expression that you used in the book about math as a communal exercise, which really I loved. I love that idea. I kind of had this mental image of a hive mind kind of working on things. Could you expand on that a little bit, what you mean by it as a communal exercise?
Yeah, I mean, I think your description as a hive is actually very good because there is this massive community of mathematicians which extends widely, both in space and time. You know, one of the amazing things about math is that we are recognizably carrying on the work of things that people 100, 200, 500 years ago were trying to do. And we very much feel them to be our colleagues. So this is kind of – it's some kind of giant four-dimensional space-time hive, if you like that. It's actually – it's a good moment to be talking about it because we've just had the Fields Medals announced, which are the biggest prizes in mathematics, or at least the most – actually not anymore the biggest monetary prizes, but the most famous ones to be sure, given out every 4 years. And this is the moment where we seem to be saying, kaboom, these are the people at the top, the pinnacle, the people who really matter, like the winners. And I think actually even if you just listen to what the medalists themselves say, they are of course all four superb mathematicians, but if you look at the work they're cited for, huge amounts of it are collaborative. And certainly the people whose work I know well, they work as part of communities. There's no question that they're leaders, but the work that they did was not done by themselves alone in a garret. The work that they did was as part of a community of people working together, bouncing ideas off each other, sharing ideas. One thing I think is great about math as a research community is that we don't tend to fight each other too much. We don't tend to race for the finish line. We don't tend to see someone else's success as our failure. It may be because there's not as much money involved for us as there is for the physicists and biologists, right? We're not racing to patent our latest theorem in order to launch a startup and like make $20 million. So maybe that's one reason we find it so easy to get along and all work together.
But everything is fundamentally built on what you do.
Of course.
Yeah. So, you know, that's interesting that you don't seem to have the same kind of competitiveness.
Right. I mean, it would be wrong to say there's no competitiveness, but I think compared to many other domains, there's an astonishing amount of willingness to share ideas, willingness to share credit.
You talk about knowing all the way to the bottom, that's what mathematics allows you to do, is to know all the way to the bottom, to touch the core. Is math really the only place you can do that?
Well, I don't like to make generalizations. I can only say that I'm 42 years old and it's the only time in my life that I feel that way. I feel that I've really understood all the way down to the bottom. I've absolutely nailed it down. Only in math have I really experienced that.
That's interesting. Because I always think, and maybe this is because I'm not a mathematician, that there's always something more to know, that there would always be something else.
Oh, well, please understand that when I say you drill all the way down to the bottom, you're trying to understand one thing. And when you get to the bottom, then you get the key that opens another door and then you start all over again. So,
okay, so we haven't finished. We just get to the bottom of that one thing.
No. Oh, yeah. My gosh.
Yeah.
No, there's so much more that we don't know than that we know.
And so math goes on.
And it will keep going on. We're not going to get to the end.
Jordan, it has been such a pleasure to have you in the studio. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks so much.
Jordan Ellenberg's new book is called How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking. Ellen Berg, who is the Vilas Distinguished Achievement Professor of Math at UW-Madison, spoke with Bonnie North.
Thank you.